This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you're a fan of the cartoons in The New Yorker, you'll recognize my guest by the initials B.E.K. That's how Bruce Eric Kaplan signs his cartoons. His work has been featured in The New Yorker for over 10 years. Kaplan has also written for the TV shows Sybil, Seinfeld, and 6 Feet Under, where he's now an executive producer. This HBO series about a family that runs a funeral home had its season premiere Sunday. Kaplan has a new book called This Is a Bad Time. It collects his cartoons from The New Yorker and other publications, including the Boston Globe and LA Weekly. I asked Kaplan to describe one of the cartoons in the book.
This is a chicken talking to a bird in a farm set, in a barn-like setting, and the chicken saying, "Sometimes I get so bored with myself, I can barely make it to doodle-doo."
No, where did that come? What made you think about that?
Oh, come on, please! Aren't you? Don't you get? You can't make it to doodle-doo some mornings.
But I wouldn't
you?
Have thought of the chicken. I just would have thought about myself.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, it's like a whole language, the world of cartoons. I mean, that there's images, classic ones, like the people crawling in the desert or the people on the deserted island. But, you know, there's a whole, is it lexicon? Is that using the word correctly?
Sure.
Of just images and worlds that you can sort of take your thoughts and plug them into. Like, a farm setting is a wonderful one, I think. I love farms. I love, not that I've ever been to one, but I love drawing them.
You mentioned desert. You have a great one of two people crawling across the desert.
Right.
Can you describe it?
Sure. It's a woman and man crawling in a desert, looking obviously starving and thirsty. And the woman turns to the man and says, "This isn't really about water. It's about what's going on between us," you know, as if they've been arguing.
Yeah. Now, how did you start drawing cartoons? What made you think, this is something I can do?
I just always drew little people. Like, you know, when I was talking on the phone or when I was drawing, I mean, when I was watching TV, I would always draw little people, little men and little women, you know, going about their business. I actually think some holding cocktail glasses the way that I still do for New Yorker cartoons. I mean, I always loved The New Yorker, so I'm sure that it was very... and I loved New Yorker cartoons when I was very little and would get, you know, the anthologies or whatever they're called out of the library or collections. So I think it was in my head that as an option, you know, as something that was out there that I could do and I like to draw.
Who were the cartoonists who you loved the most when you were a kid looking at this?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I love them all. I don't remember ever not loving one, to tell you the truth. I mean, they're just, you know, the one, I was very passionate about Charles Adams. I was definitely, like, very Charles Adams focused as a child and would, you know, take his stuff out of the library constantly, you know, all the time. I just said this the other day, so when I was taking out his books, like, all the time from the library, like, you know, every 2 weeks, I don't know why someone just didn't give me one, but they didn't.
What came first, writing for television or cartooning?
They actually came at the same time. What happened was I had been trying to write for television and not succeeding at it. And I thought, like, oh, I don't remember how it came to me, but I thought, like, I could be a New Yorker cartoonist. I mean, one day it was just like, yes, that I could do. You know, I'm not succeeding at this other thing, but this one I can do. So I, like, you know, read in the library, like, I got a book out, How to Be a Cartoonist, and it said there was an art meeting once a week, and I started submitting, you know, I did 10 drawings and sent them off with a self-addressed envelope, like the book in the library told me to do, and I was, you know, of course, like everything I did at the time, I was sure they were going to buy all 10 drawings, and I just sat there in my apartment, and I, you know, drew my next group so I wouldn't miss next week's meeting, and sent that off, and then my first envelope came back with a rejection letter, and I was so shocked. I couldn't believe it. It was this form rejection letter. I thought, like, you know, I'd sent them these brilliant things, I thought. And so I just, you know, assumed they had made a mistake on some level and that they were going to buy some of the second group. So I started working on my third group, and then, you know, of course, needless to say, I got my envelope back, the second group, and... Anyhow, it was a compulsion by this time, and I actually spent a few years sending, you know, 10, 15, 20 cartoons every week. I never missed an art meeting for a few years. And so now I was also concurrently trying to be a sitcom writer and failing at both. So now I had instead of, you know, the New Yorker cartoons were supposed to be like this easy way into like a wonderful life, and yet it was now just another thing that I was not succeeding at. But I was very compulsive, for lack of a better word. I had to do it. So then a few years into it, my friend Kenny had hired me for the Emmy Awards, and I came back from work one day, and instead of my self-addressed envelope, there was a FedEx from the New Yorker, and I just cried. I mean, because I knew something was happening, obviously, and I opened it up, and it was an acceptance letter, you know, and it was such a big deal. It was just like, I would get these little tiny, they're not even 8.5 by 11, they're like note card rejection letters that are no signature. It was like sending these off into a void. So the idea that finally someone, you know, had read them. I mean, I would write cover letters that said, like, cursing at them, saying, here are, you know, 10 bleeping cartoons that any other bleeping magazine would publish except for you. Because I figured it didn't feel like anyone was actually reading these cartoons. It just felt like they would open them up and put them in my self-addressed envelope and send them back to me. When I got the FedEx, the first line was, I know you think we haven't been reading your stuff, but we have, and here are these cartoons. We'd like you to draw, you know, revise them. And then that led to a new world of horror, because revising, I thought I was drawing these perfect things. I had no idea I was supposed to be revising these images.
What kind of revisions did they ask for?
Oh, God, it's embarrassing now, but I mean, he said, you know, I had no idea. I really did, you know, this is how I was in my 20s. I thought, these are perfect. So I called him up. It was Lee Lorenz, the art editor at the time, and I said, like, hi, I'm Bruce Kaplan. I'm excited to do these revisions, but what should I change? And he said, like, well, you see the table in that picture? It doesn't look like a table. You know, a table should have four legs. It was like that type of thing. So he would tell me, you know, things in my drawings that just really weren't cutting it.
Now, here's what confuses me. You don't seem like somebody who's brimming over with confidence. And yet, you had the confidence in these cartoons, and you thought, like, hey, any self-respecting magazine would be accepting these cartoons and publishing them.
I know. I wish. Believe me. Tell me what this is in my psyche, and you know, it saved me a lot of money. I don't have the answer for that. I do. It's like a split kind of two, you know, a duality of, like, I'm wildly confident and then also wildly not secure.
Here's a cartoon that I figure relates to writing in some way. Someone's driving in a car along a big deserted strip of highway and passes a billboard, and the billboard says, your own tedious thoughts next 200 miles. And I don't know. To me, that's not only about just kind of having to be alone for a long time on a deserted highway or alone any place like that. I just have a feeling, too, that for you as a writer, maybe it feels that way sometimes, that you have a dry spell and, like,
it's never not a dry spell for me. I'm one of those writers who, you know, moans in agony, or cartoonist constantly, you know, why are there no good ideas? You know, I despise myself. It's always the same thought going on in my head. Oh, so yes, it's completely autobiographical about writing and the creative process.
So what do you do to kind of break the dry spell when you're feeling that way? Sit there and hope for the best.
Actually, for me, it's more than hoping. I've tried everything. I mean, I've prayed, I've cried, I've, you know, kicked. But, you know, it's actually just going through that emotion to the next emotion of, well, I'm going to produce something. I'm going to write something. I'm going to draw something. And be what is interesting to me. Sometimes also it helps to go through the negative emotions in terms of, like, to do a drawing about hating oneself or about, you know, not having any ideas, and maybe that drawing will be great or not, but then it'll be exercised a little bit, and then you'll think about something else that's on your mind, and that will, you know, you'll move forward. I mean, gradually, it's always like a trick to just lose yourself in the process. And if you have faith, then you can. That's my opinion.
You've been working on Six Feet Under since the very beginning of the series, since the pilot. One of your more famous episodes is the foot episode. And in this one, in the opening death, I think it's a baker is killed in some of the baking technology and his body's mangled. And you want to describe what happens with the foot?
Yeah, I mean, the baker dies in a dough mixer, I believe, and he's, you know, his body is chopped up into different parts, and later in the episode, Claire is in the funeral home talking to Nate, and she steals a foot from, I mean, she's in the prep room talking to Nate, and she steals the foot of this man, Mr. Romano.
And she puts it in her boyfriend's locker.
She's mad at him because, he was asked, she sucked his toes and he told the school about it.
So it's a kind of gruesome, it's not treated gruesomely, it's kind of an absurdist touch, but it could be very gruesome. Whose idea was that?
That was Alan's idea. Sorry not to have that be my idea again. But yeah, I remember, Alan, this was, the third episode of the series. And I remember we were talking about stories for future episodes before the first one actually shot. And he came in one morning and said, what if Claire stole a foot? And like the second he said it, it's like, yes, Claire must steal a foot. And I definitely will write that episode because that's something I can I understand stealing a foot.
How can you understand stealing a foot?
I don't know. I haven't done it yet. But I understand the emotion behind stealing a foot and making and feeling like they wanting to make a statement with it. I just understand the sort of the operaticness of that. I connect with that.
Have you been to any funerals since you started working on the series?
Sure. Sadly, yes.
I'm wondering if writing the series kind of affects what it's like for you when you're at a funeral. I mean, not the grief itself, but just watching how the actual ceremony unfolds. Maybe it's a stupid question because you'd be much too absorbed in grief to even think about that.
No, because it's like anything in life. You're never, I'm not never too absorbed in any activity of, unfortunately.
To stop thinking.
That I can also, yeah, exactly. I wish. Please give me that activity and I'll take it all day long. It's definitely, I have a more process-oriented eye now. Like, this person is doing that. That's how, the reality of eulogies is different than the eulogies on Six Feet Under, I feel sometimes. I can't quite, I'd love for them to be the same, but I can't quite tell you why my experience or the reality of eulogies in real life is different. Maybe it's just because, again, it's just real life versus, drama.
Now, I think we've established that you have your own share of neuroses. Now, you used to write for Seinfeld,
mm-hmm.
which, so much of the show was about each of the characters, like neuroses and issues. And then I think, Larry David is the co-creator and was the head writer. And certainly, his persona on his own show on HBO is somebody who is just so incredibly neurotic and self-absorbed and unempathetic. mm-hmm. And then there's...
It's funny to hear you describe it because it's like I have such a different experience of it.
Oh, good. Well, that's what I want to hear.
Sure. For both Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm, I think, I think like, oh God, these are such fully developed human, real people.
I
never could put it in terms of neuroses or that type of thing. Cause to me, it's just like, they're people. They're just, people who, and in their fully naked or, they're exposed. And this is sort of, they're vain and they're funny and they're interested and they're not interested and they're, sort of greedy, but they're also altruistic, I guess, sometimes. They are, So it just seems like people in their full regalia, whatever that is.
Right, naked and in their full regalia.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. But what was it like working on Seinfeld with what must have been a pretty interesting and maybe combustible mix of personalities? Because you got Larry David, then you get Jerry Seinfeld, and, just watching him.
Oh, this is a factual one. I can correct you on this. I worked on the final season of
Seinfeld. Larry David was already gone.
Yeah, he came to do the final episode, but he wasn't really there for the bulk of the year.
So. Well, the final series of Seinfeld, the final season of Seinfeld, by that time, you know, Seinfeld started as a show that was, quote, about nothing. It was just about, like, little day-to-day things in life, you know, shopping for an air conditioner and losing your car in the shopping mall, not being able to find it, that kind of thing. By the end, the stories were really kind of extravagantly impossible. How did you feel about writing for that end of the series when it was no longer a show about the little details in life as much as it was about these really improbable things happening to all the characters?
Again, this wasn't my experience of it. I mean, it definitely, the show became more stylized in the final two seasons, and the stories kept getting bigger and bigger. But at the same time, they were very rooted in real sort of emotions. Like I mean, one of the ones I wrote was about Elaine getting frustrated because she doesn't understand a New Yorker cartoon, which is, you know, it's a very natural thing that happens to people, I believe. Or, you know, in another episode I wrote, she was upset by someone at work who, you know, sidled up too close to her, and she didn't enjoy that. So I think they were grounded in reality things. They sort of then, by the end of the second act, just really ballooned. But it was fun. I enjoyed it.
In the episode where Elaine is confused about the meaning of a New Yorker cartoon, does she also try to become a cartoonist in that?
Yes. In the second act, she decides that, like, that, you know, if they could, if this is what they're publishing, and then she could definitely do a better job. And she comes up with one, and it ends up, you know, they buy it and they publish it, and it ends up being a cartoon that she unconsciously ripped off from a Ziggy cartoon.
Do you remember the cartoon?
Yeah, Ziggy's at the complaint department, and he's saying, "I have a complaint. I wish I were taller," something like that. That's the bad cartoon, everybody. I hope everyone knows that.
Oh, okay.
It was the cartoon, you know, the whole gang, like, you know, George and Jerry and Kramer. No one can believe that she thinks this is funny, you know, and Kramer is like, it would be much funnier if he was saying, "My wife is a slut." I don't know. You had to be there.
So it wasn't a real Ziggy cartoon? You made this one up?
Oh, no. Yeah, it was a false Ziggy. Yes, we created our own Ziggy for that episode.
I'm going to get back to another cartoon. And this one is of a couple in bed. And one of them is saying to the other, "I don't understand how people with full lives do it."
That, right, I know. I feel the same way.
What inspired that?
I remember thinking it. I remember thinking about these two people. I mean, it was just, I don't know how they do it. I don't, you know, they have a full life. How is it possible? I mean, again, this is one of those where it's true. It's I know on some level it's funny, but hearing you say it, it's like in the moment, it's not. How do they do it? Please, I want the answer.
One final question. When you sign your cartoons, your name is Bruce Eric Kaplan, but you sign them B-E-K, and each of those initials is boxed. And so
Yes. The
boxes are adjoining. Did I describe that okay?
Yes, beautifully.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
How did you, two things, why do you use your middle name, Eric, and how did you come up with your signature?
Okay, first thing, the first answer, I remember feeling like Bruce Kaplan wasn't enough. It had to be my whole name, Bruce Eric Kaplan. Like, I just felt like that's who I am creatively. I am my whole name, but whatever that means. And then, but the second is, how did I come up with the boxes? I think, in the early days of doing the cartoons, just doing the signature, and it just felt like it was, everything was wrong, the script and how long it was and how much space it took up and just the script, it just didn't look right with this, you know, world that I have. And I remember playing around with things and coming up with the B-E-K because this is like, this felt like, oh yes, this is a part of this world, the B-E-K.
Well, Bruce Eric Kaplan, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Bruce Eric Kaplan is a cartoonist for The New Yorker. His new collection of cartoons is called This Is a Bad Time. Kaplan is also an executive producer of the HBO series 6 Feet Under, which had its premiere of the season on Sunday.